Greetings, folks. It is Dave and
John. And guess what?
What?
You know what we thought we'd do, Dave?
What?
Well, I think we're in a particularly good mood with the nice weather and all that. But, you know, I figured, why the heck not let everybody listen in on the latest episode?
That's right. So we just recorded the premium episode number 271, and we finished it and then decided, you know, it's been a little while since we've given a premium free sample out. Why not? Happy summer, end of June, yada, yada, yada. Here you go. So premium free sample, right to follow right now. It'll be right now. So thanks. And of course, I'd be remiss, and we would be remiss, if we didn't say, if you want more of this, $25 for 6 months. But here it is, a free sample, no strings attached.
Yep, and it's a great mix. Yeah. We got some theoretical, we got some very hardcore technical stuff. But you'll see that once you listen to it.
That's
a lot
right.
of good tips, a lot of good discussion. And yeah, maybe you'll sign up.
And so that's right. Away we go. The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 271 Premium for Wednesday, June 30th, 2010. Greetings, folks, and welcome to Wednesday. Yes, it's Wednesday, John. And thanks for subscribing to our premium show. Subscription. We very much appreciate that. How you doing, John?
Fantastic.
Lantastic, like we used to say back in the 90s, right?
I didn't say that.
You didn't?
And I'm not going to talk about the great weather where it's 70-something degrees and 40% humidity.
It's perfect.
Just one of these days that you like, where New England is cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
but we're not
absolutely.
Going to talk about that.
No, but you know, I did want to talk about troubleshooting my printer simply because it honors the troubleshooting process, which was something that I had not been doing with this particular problem for a while. So I want to share this anecdote because hopefully in a very general sense might help one or two of you specifically, but in a general sense, it hopefully will help a lot of the our listeners and perhaps
your
even
printer.
You,
what printer would this be, Dave?
So my HP 3055, which is a LaserJet all-in-one fax, scanner, copier, printer. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Black and white laser printer that does all that other great stuff. And it has we talked about it in a couple of shows. I mentioned it anecdotally about when we were talking about another user that had or a listener that had a Xerox printer that they couldn't get to work with Snow Leopard. And I said, I'm having the same problem with mine. So the HP has not released Snow Leopard drivers for this yet. It took them a while to release Leopard drivers for it, even though the printer came out right before Leopard did. But it took them a while, and so you had to sort of jury-rig the drivers with the Tiger drivers with Leopard to get it to work, and then the Leopard drivers came out, and it was fine. And there have been reports of needing to jury-rig the Leopard drivers to make it work with Snow Leopard. I hadn't really had any problems, and I was okay with that. And then 10.6.3 came out, and it was after 10.6.3 came out that I realized I couldn't scan anymore. It would act like it was going to scan, but it wouldn't scan. But, you know, the printer is still copying everything. So I knew that, you know, I just assumed, okay, well, all those issues that people said they were having with Snow Leopard in this, here I am. I'm now one of those people. And so I left it at that. And every now and then I would try. And if I had a free moment, I'd reinstall the printer software and see what would happen. And then it sort of hit me the other day, yesterday. I thought, you know, I got to get something scanned. Why don't I, run Parallels or VMware or something to, right, to do it in Windows? Because the Windows software has been up to date and, you know, so, you know, I got to get this thing scanned. So let me try that. So I did that and I started it up and, you know, Parallels and VMware are sort of their own little beasts. So it's not like running boot camp or even better, just running a straight Windows machine where you know that it's seeing all the hardware in the network. But I figured it should be fine. And so
now,
I started. Go ahead.
I just want to ask, though.
Yeah.
I mean, my experience with the VMs is that now was this connected by USB or via
no, it's
Ethernet?
Ethernet and to be clear, I always set up for the virtual machines that I run with either. And I was using VMware yesterday, but either VMware or Parallels. The ones that I set up using that, I always set up in whatever native network mode is. So it's not sharing my Mac's Ethernet connection and doing yet another level of routing inside the software. Mm-hmm. it gets an IP. I always make sure the virtual machine gets an IP address on my network that's on the same subnet as my Macs. So it's an equal participant in the network. So there's no funkiness there.
Okay. Right? Cause I've had, I found that network support is a lot better than USB support. Cause typically these things are, do not, that they have like a virtual USB driver and you know, and I think we actually had an issue also where Bonjour, where the preference would be, as you did, rather than bridging or doing NAT, is to give it its own IP address because you're because I remember we talked about this before, is that Bonjour in a VM has problems if you try to use the same if you try to do if you're not getting your own IP address.
Right.
So but go on. I thought it'd be worth mentioning this because I've been through that. My laser, which is networked, works great if I, you know, give the VM its own IP address. So
sure.
Go on.
So, you know, so I downloaded the 360 megabyte, you know, software install for the printer because I wanted the scanner software and all that crap. Right. So I download that. I go through the installation process. It installs. It reboots a couple of times during the process, et cetera. But it definitely sees the printer. I can tell because it, you know, when you first initialize the printer from any computer, you have to kind of plug in what its fax number is and some details. And I see those details populated on my Windows, you know, installation. So there's no way those could have magically gotten there. It's definitely talking to the printer. Okay, great. And I do a test page and it prints. Okay, good. Now I run the scan software. And it says, yep, I see it as a scanner. And I go to scan and it comes up and it says, no, I can't scan because something else, some other device is talking to the scanner. Like, okay, all right, fine. You know, so now I'm like, well, is it my Mac? And then it hit me. It's like, wait a minute. You know, I've turned this, certainly turned this on and off plenty of times in hopes of resurrecting its scanning functionality on the Mac. But the one thing I hadn't done was a factory defaults reset. I'd even updated the firmware on it in hopes that that would fix it, but yet hadn't done a factory default. So I walked over to the office here and I went to the front of the printer and I changed it. You know, I went in and said factory defaults, fine. Then I ran the printer setup assistant, this time on my Mac, you know, went back through all that, named it, gave it its fax number, yada, 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 boom, it scanned just fine. So the problem, lo, these many months, has been that the printer simply got its own settings corrupted and needed to be wiped clean. But were it not for testing it on the Windows side, I never would have thought, oh, yeah, of course, that's the problem. You know, I just assumed the error was a Snow Leopard HP, you know, incompatibility thing when in fact, no, it was just that the device itself needed a good, you know, a good shake in the boots, if you will. I don't know what that phrase means, but it sounds good.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, you know, hey, always honor the troubleshooting process and don't just assume, you know, where the problem is.
To me, it sounds like when in doubt, reset is.
Yeah, but I, you know, I'd reset the computer. I'd turn the printer on and off. One would assume that would, you know, how in the world does resetting? There's no settings on the printer for the scanner, right? I have no, you know, the printer's got a kind of a very crude memory menu system that you can access from the front panel, and I can set, you know, how many rings does it answer on the fax and how dark are the copies and blah, blah, blah. All, you know, all that stuff. There's not a single setting in there that even has anything to do with the scanner. So it just never occurred to me that, oh, hey, you know, factory reset the settings because everything else works. It's just the scanner. But sure, that'll fix it. Sure enough, that fixed it.
Nice.
Yeah, good. So we have. So now that we've got that out of the way, lots of questions and tips that came in from you over the last couple of weeks. Let's reverse the order here, John. Let's start with tips, shall we?
We shall.
Okay. So Jim writes, and strangely enough, we have no audio comments in today's show. And of course, today's the day that I seem to be getting my semi-annual summer cold. So I get to just read all these questions all day, which is great. Jim writes, and I'm happy to do it for all of you. Just been listening to Mac Geek Gab 268, and John described how he managed to restore files from /user from Time Machine. Here's a quick tip that would have saved a couple of steps. From the Finder's go to folder menu command has the keyboard equivalent of Shift Apple G. If you hit this same key combo when any standard open save dialog has focus in any application, the same go to folder sheet that you get in the Finder will slide out of the dialog and you can type in any location. So this is actually pretty cool. And I couldn't find it documented anywhere, but it definitely works. And I tried it on a machine that does not have default folder installed just to make sure that it wasn't some magic of default folders, since so many of us seem to rely on that anyway. But yeah, sure enough, Command Shift G pops that little thing up. You can type the location and boom, it brings the open save dialog right there, which is really cool.
Likewise, I verified that too. So that's I looked in the keyboard shortcuts and it was not listed anywhere there. That's about it. So yeah, that would have saved me a couple of keystrokes.
I can think of times in the past when this would have been hugely valuable, especially with a piece of software like BB Edit or something where I want to go and find a file that's not necessarily part of the tree that I'm shown. Very, very handy. So cool. Greg, along those same keyboard shortcuts line, writes, "As you can see from the screenshots that I sent," which of course you can't, but we'll describe it, "I programmed some keyboard shortcuts for shutdown, restart, and sleep." And the way Greg did this, he programmed commands or control space for sleep, control R for restart, and control O for shutdown. The way he did this was he went into System Preferences, Keyboard, and then on the Keyboard Shortcuts tab, he did... In the Finder app, he added these keyboard shortcuts. So you find the application that you want to add a keyboard shortcut to, and then you hit the plus sign, and then you start adding them, right? You name the menu item and the keyboard shortcut, and it will add them there. Now, I'm curious if doing that, adding that to the Finder, does that then add it to all apps? Because...
No. To clarify... So what you want to do is when you're in keyboard shortcuts on the left, you will see a number of options. The one that he clicked on, and it's actually broken in half in the notes that I have in front of me here. You want to first click on application shortcuts.
Thank you.
And then when you do that, you'll see on the window on the right, the plus and the minus. Now, if you hit a plus, that's going to add a new one. And what happens is when you click on the plus, you will then have an option to select the application. And you'll basically get a list of every application on your machine. And at least on when I tried this, the first one that was listed was Finder. When it lists this in the window, it lists it as Finder.app.
Of course.
So this, at least this one, is specific to just Finder.
Well, my guess is, though, you could add this for all applications since the sleep, restart, and shutdown are available in all apps. So you could... hit that plus sign, leave it as all applications. And then let me see if this works for him here. So we'll do shutdown and we'll do control O, even though I don't really like that. But let's see.
I think he did a zero. It looks like a zero.
Maybe. So I definitely have it in the Finder. Let me see. Do I have it? Yep. I have it in all my apps. What's interesting though, is I've now added another command. Right, because shutdown is usually shutdown dot 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 with the three ellipses, and interestingly enough, by choosing shutdown without it, by writing shutdown without the three ellipses, it actually adds a command to the Apple menu, which is an interesting little quirk. So that would, I were to hit Control O right now, this podcast would be over because it would shut down without the ellipses. And that means there's no dialogue, no confirmation. And down she goes.
Yeah, so I
removed that. Yeah, I cannot do that. but cool. That's great, Greg. That's one of those things that you tend to, or at least I tend to forget about. So that's cool. All right. So on to questions that come along with tips. Scott writes, "I have what should be a quick question, but I've been looking and haven't found an answer on my own. I'm going on a long vacation and have a potential problem with iTunes and podcasts. I have a few podcasts which I subscribe to, but only listen to when I have time. I've noticed that iTunes will occasionally stop downloading them and put up an exclamation point icon. When I click on this icon, it will tell me that I haven't been viewing or listening to this in a while, and then ask me if I want to continue the downloads. This is fine in most cases. However, some of the NPR podcasts will disappear after a day if I don't download them. Do you know of a way to force iTunes to continue to download podcasts while I'm on vacation for 4 weeks?" Okay, so there's a couple of options here. The first is something I use called Doug's Apple Scripts. It's a website, and there's a script there called Update Expired Podcasts, and it's currently at version 2.0. We'll put a link in the show notes. When you install this, it adds a script menu to iTunes if you don't have one already. And then in that menu, it adds Update Expired Podcasts. And when you choose this, it runs through all your podcasts and essentially gets rid of that exclamation point and restores them to syncing. What's happening here is that iTunes monitors what you listen to. It decides if you haven't listened to X number of episodes, and I think it's three, then it stops updating and stops downloading for that podcast. So that
I thought it was a time. I saw, I did a little digging too, and I came to the same conclusion, is that the only way to fix this is that script. But I believe the delta is 2 weeks. If iTunes doesn't see you do anything with a podcast, listen to it for 2 weeks, it's going to assume that you're bored with it and you don't want to listen anymore. It's going to put up those. And I saw plenty of forms and pages and people just shaking their fists at Apple saying, can't you please give me a way to undo this behavior? And as far as I found, there is no way through iTunes to do this.
Correct.
The only way is what you found, Dave.
Right. Now this only is half the solution here for Scott, because Scott needs this script to run automatically. And I believe, and that won't happen in iTunes. This is a manually run script. That said, you might be able to use a piece of software called Chronix, which ties into the Unix cron daemon, which is a little thing that runs and schedules various events. And Chronix will allow you to manage that daemon from a graphical user interface, from a GUI. So that in theory should work, although you're relying on a lot of things to kind of sync up together. What I would do, John, mm-hmm. is I would run Net Newswire, which is an RSS feed reader, feed aggregator, and you can add podcasts to it. Remember, before iTunes supported podcasts, we all had to have different ways of slurping these things in. And I used NetNewsWire, and it's still out there. And you can tell it to download the attachments, which is what the podcast is, from any given feed. And you can customize it feed by feed automatically. And you can even tell it to add them to iTunes. So what I would do is, to be safe, I just run NetNewsWire, feed it all your podcasts, and then just let it automatically download. Tell it to update once an hour. Heck, you know, it doesn't matter. You're not there. You don't need the bandwidth. And that way it's just slurping the stuff down as soon as it comes out.
Right. And here's the other thing that I would do, Dave.
Yep. Go.
First, I think iTunes, most people recognize that Apple really hasn't done a heck of a lot with iTunes in a while.
Yep.
I would go to the iTunes menu. There's a choice, provide iTunes feedback.
Yeah.
And just send a note to Apple saying,
send a note to the black hole, you mean?
I assume somebody reads these.
Yeah, they probably do. They probably do.
But yeah, I've had this happen often, Dave, and it just aggravates me where something comes up and it's like, look, if I'm signed up to it, kind of assume that even if I don't listen to it, kind of do what I tell you, which is, and you know, there are other settings. I mean, we've seen this, what is this software? Castaway used to provide a pretty fine-grained level of control that I think iTunes, for the most part, except for this, will deal with properly, and that, you know, I want to maintain, you know, 5 episodes, 10 episodes. If you look now, when you click on a podcast, that when you're signed up to it, there'll be a settings button, and it'll let you either do default behavior or somewhat customize it. But this behavior, as far as I can see, is not customizable, is that you're always going to have this 2 week expiration where it assumes if you don't listen to it, you're not interested. And I think that's a poor assumption.
Yeah. I mean, I get why you might want something like this, but certainly you also want to be able to customize. I agree. All right.
Maybe they're concerned that, Apple knows best, you know, like, hey, if you don't listen to it for a couple of weeks, then you're probably not interested. Maybe that's a valid assumption.
Then we've defined that we're not assuming, we know you're not interested anymore. That's right.
Right.
So yeah, but that Doug's Apple Scripts thing is cool, because I'm in the same boat, and I've been using this for a while, where if I, you know, a lot of my podcast, I have those podcasts, the couple of podcasts that I listen to religiously no matter what, but then there's a bunch that I just like to have access to. perhaps I've got, you know, a long drive home from a gig or to a gig or whatever, alone time in the car. And it's like, oh, if only I had this. Now, you know, with the iPhone, I can download it over 3G, but then I got to plug my iPhone into the car instead of the iPod that's already there, et cetera, et cetera. So what I wind up using this because, if I don't gig for a while, then I'm not listening to those kind of podcasts, right? So I use this as an easy way to go through and just bam, you know, refresh them all, go get everything I want, and then I'll sync it out to my iPod and I'm good to go. So, yeah, it's a handy thing. Definitely.
I'm like you. I have some that I pretty much only listen to when I'm traveling. And actually points out, like some of the NPR ones, normally I listen to them on the radio.
Right.
But I still, if I'm going to travel, I'd still like to have the latest, you know, five or whatever, which is how I set it up. And I'd still like to have those go into my device and not find out, oh man, you know, it thought that I wasn't interested.
Yeah, missed the boat.
There.
Yeah.
All right.
Moving on to Mark. As long as I can find his question in here, which I can. Eureka. Mark says, I recently purchased a pristine 3-year-old MacBook Pro from a friend. Everything's working just great, but I'm noticing a little confusion as to how much RAM is actually in this machine or how much it's seeing and using. The About This Mac pane and the system profilers seem to think there are 4 gigabytes inside, while Activity Monitor and menu meters both report 3 gigabytes. And he sent some screenshots to confirm this, and that's exactly what it shows. Mark says, I'm not wild about the idea of opening it up and looking inside, and I'm not sure what that would tell me anyway. Any thoughts, suggestions about how to know how much RAM is really in my computer or to access the missing gigabyte? John, you want to take this one? I think you and I both came to the same conclusion on this.
I'm going to take this one.
Go.
So what I found, now, first off, they're not paying me to say this, though, if they'd like to, and maybe throw a couple of bucks or some memberships your way, Dave. But I went to OWC or, you know, maxsales.com. And now he said this machine is about 3 years old. And so what I did is I went to their site and, you know, I've as of late, I've gotten all my memory from them because they do a great amount of research in figuring out what is the reality with these machines as far as how much RAM is. As some of you may recall, I have 6 gigs in my early 2007, same one you have, Dave, early 2007.
Right.
MacBook Pro. And even though Apple says 4 gigs, OWC said, now you can really do 6. And yes, I can do 6.
Yeah, those guys have their own lab out there in Illinois. And they do a lot of research. They know what they're doing. They're not just a reseller of parts that they get somewhere else. I mean, certainly they do some of that. But even with those parts, they run them through the lab and they really do understand what's going on. As John pointed out, kind of to crystallize that, for things like this, especially with regards to RAM and what works and doesn't work in your Mac, OWC is a fantastic resource. I don't think of them as a company that's going to try and sell me something, even though they do and happily will. But you know, they are a resource, a place to go to get that information. So for sure. So go ahead.
The one thing you want to do before you go to these guys is to identify. Now Mark did not identify specifically his machine, but I found a note on their site, which led me to believe that this is the machine. And here was the note that they had. So under MacBook, so I looked under MacBook and they list different levels of MacBook and how much RAM it can handle, but they had a little caveat for this machine. So this machine, I'm going to guess, is a MacBook Core 2 Duo, either 1.83 gigahertz or 2.16 gigahertz, either a late 2006 or I'm going to guess a mid 2007 because he said it was about 3 years old. And their note says these models are able to accept a matched pair of 2 gigabyte modules for 4 gigabyte total, but only fully utilize the first 3 gigabytes of installed memory, which sounds to me like exactly what he's running into. But then they have another note here, which I think is great.
Yep.
Even so, even with these systems, there is some benefit to having a matched pair of 4 gigabytes installed. And they even have a benchmark showing this. And the reason for that is that in a lot of Macs, if you have a matched pair, in that if the machine has 2 RAM slots and you have the same exact same type of RAM chip in both slots, you will realize typically a 5% or so increase in performance versus if you had 2 different sized or differently configured chips. So
got it.
It sounds like he has the best configuration. And even though, as we know, Mac OS X can access way more, you know, even though, in some cases, some consider it a 32 gigabyte operating system, 32 bit, it can access way more RAM than that. So this is, I think, just a limitation.
We talked about it when it came out. I think it's a limitation of the memory controller in there. There was some bug or something that if it tried to address more than 3 gigabytes, you know, all heck would break loose. So I think Apple artificially limited it to only addressing those three. And that's why the machine will know that it has more, but it can't use it. So. All right, let's move on to Jason here with a topic that comes up pretty regularly, maybe once a couple times a year, probably, but very worth revisiting because it's always good. Jason writes, after listening to you for many years and even making it to your Macworld 2009 public session, this is my first question. I remember hearing you both talk about different ways of buying AppleCare in the past. Since AppleCare is like insurance, it's possible for some businesses to buy bulk packages of AppleCare and then sell it for a significant discount. I think it was about 2 years ago when you mentioned various online stores, and even though I bookmarked these sites, I can't find them. Online searches are coming up empty as well. Do you still know of any good places to buy AppleCare with some discount? I'm in the market for 3 boxes, all for MacBook Pros, the more expensive version, of course. So any savings would be great, beside Apple's $350. My 1 year warranty expires in a few weeks. All right. So I have 3 places that I look, and John, I think you have a couple other places.
Mm-hmm.
The 3 are, and we'll put all these links in the show notes, of course. Small Dog, they are consistently one of the lower priced Apple Cares. LA Computer Company is a place where I've wound up buying. I think I have Apple Care on my current machine from LA Computer. And then Amazon is another one where you can get it for discounts. Now, it's important to note a couple of things about at least these 3 places, and really anywhere. They don't always all have availability for AppleCare for everything. When you're buying from one of these places, you're actually buying a boxed AppleCare product. Really what it is, it's a box. It's got TechTool Pro, I think, in there, or TechTool Deluxe. I can't remember which one. And then a sheet of paper that's got a little code on it. You take that code, you go to a site or a page at apple.com, and you plug in your serial number and that code, and then that magically adds AppleCare to your Mac. Now, here's the thing. If you go and buy it from Apple for presumably full price, though, John, you're going to talk about how that might not be necessary. But if you go and buy it from Apple, you can register that day. So if your warranty, let's say your warranty expires 2 days from now, you could go and buy it from Apple and boom, it's registered immediately. There's no questions, no issues. It works. If I order it from, say, Small Dog today and it doesn't get here until 3 days from now, well, I'm still technically covered because I've been in this situation before. And what you have to do is when you go online to do it, it'll say, oh, no, wait a minute, your warranty's expired. So you can't do AppleCare, but you can call them up, and then what they'll have you do is fax in a copy of your order receipt from Apple, from, you know, Small Dog or wherever you've purchased it from, to prove that you ordered it before your warranty expired. And as long as you do that, and they're not crazy, you know, about the process, that, you know, they'll take a Xerox or a scan of a receipt or whatever you want. I think I've even emailed in a scan before. And it works just fine. But you got to go through an extra song and dance to make that happen. So a couple of options. One is if you're right at the end, it may be worth the premium of buying it direct from Apple. But number 2 is just don't let it get to the end and then you're all right.
Right. So the other thing I'll mention.
Go ahead.
Oh, I got a bunch of things. So number 1 thing that I would recommend is that when you get any piece of Apple equipment, they typically try to prod you into registering your product. And sometimes they'll be able to grab the serial number off of it, and sometimes you may have to provide it manually. It's usually, you know, like with iPods and stuff like that.
Sure.
If you do that, that can only help your case if you are getting down to the wire, as they've mentioned. And if Apple is already aware of the product, the reason I mention this is, for example, I have an old one of the white, I mean, I think it was like a 2G or 3G iPod with the hard drive, you know, totally white with the, it was a monochrome display. And it started freaking out on me, and I'm like, you know what? I wonder what my options are to get this repaired. Because I was a good person, or at least I think that makes me a good person, or it certainly can't hurt, I registered that product. They actually had it on file. They're like, yeah, can you enter the serial number of your iPod, whatever it was? I think it was called iPod Touch Wheel or something. What was the name of it?
Okay.
They had it on file. And they basically said, here are your options. You can talk to someone, click this button, and we'll let you talk to someone at Apple. You can send it into a, or we'll recommend a repair shop. Now, of course, this thing is ancient, so
yeah,
it wouldn't even be worth fixing it. I mean, maybe as a as an exercise for me to just see if I can fix it. I mean, I'm almost positive the hard drive is shot.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, what happened is I'd start playing songs, and basically any song I played after 30 seconds, the thing would reset. So it was either the memory controller, I suspect, or the hard drive. But anyways, they knew about it because I registered it when I bought it. So advice to everybody, when you get your Apple product, you know, even when you register it, you can uncheck the box and they won't spam you if you consider it spam.
Right.
But just have that serial number on file with Apple, because it can only help you if you're in a situation like this. Now, number two, there are ways to get a discount through Apple. You may be surprised at this, Dave, or
I was
if you're listening.
At this, yeah.
Well, check this out. Well, normally, if you go through the normal Apple store, you're not going to get a discount for the MacBook Pro 15 and 17 inch, and they actually segregate these. So the MacBook 13 inch or MacBook Pro
right.
13 inch costs less. But this machine, Jason said, I think this is he said it's a bigger one, so it's either 15 or 17 inch. The normal price of Apple Care for that is $349, as he pointed out. Now, there are two ways to get a discount. One, if you work for a big company, you can get a slight discount. And the way you can find that out, either check with your company and say, do we have an employee purchase program with Apple? Or here's the secret, and don't tell anybody.
Yeah, that's right.
Between
us. Between us.
Is www.apple.com/EPP store, EPP being employee purchase program. Then a slash, and then the name of your company.
And you can get there just by going to the Apple store and clicking on for business, I think, and then typing your company's name in.
Oh, okay. I didn't find that. I found if I just clicked on for business, it would give me the same prices.
Oh.
So I don't know if that's really a path to get here. But anyways, EPP store, and then put the name of a company. Now, one thing you could do if you have a lot of time to kill is just insert the name of any company and see if they have a purchase program. Microsoft, lots of companies do. Now, just keep in mind, I'm just going to say, I don't know how rigorously Apple verifies that you actually work for a company.
Sure.
Before you log in, they will say, you know, you better really be working for this company before you claim to be entitled to a discount. So I don't know if they're going to send the Apple cops or whatever, but you know, come on.
Right.
I'm going to leave it to the listener to decide how to proceed on this.
Of course. But if you work for a big company, that's an easy way of finding out if you are eligible for this.
Absolutely. And what I found here is the price for Apple Care for a 15 or 17 inch MacBook Pro is $307.
Okay. So you're saving $43 or $42.
That's a pretty good discount. Now, here's a better one, because, you know, Apple wants to get you early. You know, it's kind of like drugs, you know, the first one. No. Well, no, it's always been Apple's strategy to try to enter the education market. And the thing is, you can also go to the Apple store. And then if you go to the Apple store, you will see on the left side of your screen the education store.
Right.
Now, if you go to the education store, now I just took, and this may not be typical, maybe it is, but I went and it'll ask for your zip code. And so I typed in my zip code. They have two classifications. I think it's higher education and, you know, not higher education, you know, right. High school or middle school. And they said, type in your zip code. So I typed in my zip code, higher education. As it turns out, there are two universities in the town that I live in, and it listed one of them. I'm not quite sure why it didn't list the other. So I clicked on, surprise, Fairfield University, and then went to the AppleCare section. And check this out, Dave. So I clicked on Apple Care for 15 and 17 inch.
Yeah.
$239.
Whoa.
I thought I made a mistake. I tried it again. $239.
$239. Okay. So Apple's $349 in the regular store. LA Computer, $295 for that one. I'm looking at Small Dog here just to check some prices. Small Dog is $289. So, okay, a little bit better. Yep. Amazon, I've got coming up real quick here. Amazon's $294. Okay, so they're all in that, you know, $290 to $300 range.
Yeah.
And now Apple takes another $60 off of that. Whoa.
Now, I'm going to almost, I'm not sure. I didn't look in detail to see exactly how they verify that you actually attend this university.
I might have some secondhand knowledge on that particular
Excellent,
process.
Because you're in a college town too, right?
Sure. And we're all students of life, aren't we?
maybe not UNH, but of life. Sure.
Of life in general. But they don't have that school. So pick the one, you know, the closest approximate one to you. But yeah, they don't check. That's all I have to say on that matter.
All right. Well, I guess it depends on you know, karma or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
If you're comfortable with doing this, I mean, again, right. I think legally you agree that you state that you attend the university.
You definitely do. Yep. But they don't check. So, you know, if you, you know, let's say you've, and here's probably why they don't check, but let's say you've applied to the school and you've gotten accepted, but it's, you know, it's June. You don't have a student ID yet. You don't have, you know, how are they going to know? They don't know. So they trust you, and that's that. So,
well, I'm going to say they may trust you at the point of purchase, Dave. I'm just going to speculate here. And actually, again, I know we have our Apple moles out there.
Oh, yeah.
Some of you could, you know, enlighten us here, but I'm curious if you actually try to file an AppleCare claim, they may be like, oh, by the way, could you either send us a transcript or a student ID?
No.
Okay.
No. We've secondhand knowledge, of course, but I've seen warranty work performed on hardware purchased from the education store, and no questions have been asked.
All right. Well, I'm still going to err on the side of being ethical and
of course, and
say that you shouldn't do this unless you attend a educational institution.
That's right.
Which could be the University of Life.
The University of Life. That's right. All right. I think we're done with this one, right? Right.
Absolutely. Yes?
Okay. So Greg has a question, and I like these kind of questions. We'll just let it go with that. So Greg writes, I'm a Mac tech and own a small business. Since you have done this type of work that I do, and many of your listeners may have a Mac repair or consulting business, I thought this question to be appropriate. And I agree with you, Greg. It's a great question. And it's a little bit long, the question, and the answer is going to be even longer. So, but it's a good discussion. I usually do on-site work at their home or office, as I do not have a storefront. I recently went over to a client's home the other day who has an Intel Mac Mini. I did the usual diagnostics and updates on his computer and updated his Mini to 10.6.4 after I did a Time Machine backup. The day after, he called and told me his Apple Pro speakers were not working, but they are showing up as USB in the sound prefs. I told him to do several troubleshooting steps, but that did not fix the issue. He has the Apple Pro speakers, which are from the year 2002, I believe, and I think he must be using an iFire adapter by Griffin to get this to work with his system, as that's the only way I know he could use these speakers with this computer. I didn't check, but I'll bet he has the iFire. I know you guys will probably say to remove all USB connections and zap the PRAM, but zapping the PRAM didn't work for the guy in the Apple discussion link I found, so I feel I would rather diagnose than troubleshoot the problem in person. I looked online and found others had the same issue, and as you can see, it was resolved by booting from an external disk in 10.6.3 and then going back to the internal boot drive. Here's my question. My client emailed me to tell me he didn't want to pay for me to come back as it was working before I came. I do have an external boot drive with 10.6.3 on it, so I can try to do it the way the guy fixed it in the discussion threads I found. I wanted to know what you guys have done in this situation, as I'm sure it's come up for you before. When we do updates, some hardware and software may not be compatible with the update, and that's just the way it is. But the clients don't understand this. They know only their work computer worked before I came. I feel like I should at least charge for an hour of my time and travel. Normally, I have a 2-hour minimum plus travel. He's about a 30-minute drive away. I have a feeling he may not go for the charge, and I may lose him as a client if I try to charge him, but I'm willing to take that risk. Okay. So then he follows up by saying, if any feedback you have from experience would be great. So I actually have a ton of feedback and experience in this particular department. And it had become one of my favorite topics to discuss. In fact, I still talk about it, even though we're not in that business anymore. I talk about it with our sales reps and really everybody here. That, you know, when I was in Austin, not only did I have my own consulting clients, but we grew it to a point where we managed a bunch of people that were out in the field. It was kind of a pre-Geek Squad thing. The business was called Computer Nerds, and it still exists today. I sold my interest in it, but it's actually doing very, very well. So, again, we were out in the field constantly doing this stuff. And there's a couple things to talk about here. In a nutshell, this comes down to why 10.6.4 was installed, right? And was the customer involved in that decision? Even if the decision's based on your advice, getting the customer to agree and want the upgrade is the key. And this kind of goes a little bit deeper. When going to any consulting job, and really any job, I always made it the priority of it being me and the customer versus their computer and its problems, as opposed to the customer versus me and their computer. And when training new employees, I always called it moving to their side of the desk. Right. So when I get there, you know, before I walk in the door, it's your computer and your problems. That doesn't change just because I'm there. I'm there. Your computer didn't call me to help it. Right. Mm-hmm. You called me to help with your computer. And it's important to maintain that that message in everything that happens. Right. You're the your help. You're the advocate. You were brought in as the expert, but it's up to the customer to make the critical decisions. Right. So they're paying you for your time and your expertise, but they get to do as they see fit. Now, I had this problem in a couple of times where nerds, as we call them, would go out and just change someone's computer to be the way they would want it to be. And if that's what the customer wants, that's great. But if, you know, what there were always two steps to making any changes to a computer, or three steps. One, figuring out what you thought you should do. Number two, very, very important step, sitting down with the customer, showing them what you found and what you think the right solution would be and why. And then perhaps also saying, but there might be a caveat here or there. And then let the customer make the decision. If they choose to follow your advice, great. If they choose not to, that's okay too. Right. They're not paying you for solutions. They're paying you for time and expertise.
Very good. And I think I'm with you on that. So if this person had been, if the agreement was, I will stop by and run diagnostics and apply any of the latest Mac software updates to your computer. And that's our agreement, which it sounds like that's what it was.
Yeah.
Then to me, I just want to interject a bit, but yeah, to me, no, that sounds like the agreement.
Yeah.
Is I'm going to stop by, I'm going to run, you know, whatever disk, you know, make sure your disk is okay.
Yeah.
You know, whatever diagnostics. And if there's a, you know, this is something I actually do with my parents, which I'm like the unofficial consultant, is
of
anytime
course.
I stop by,
we all are right
for the mom, you know, I'll run, you know, whatever, I'll run software update. If there's anything new, I'll apply it. I don't really think about it. And I think I mentioned in the past, well, the thing is, when I did the big upgrade from her old iBook to the new MacBook, I said, you know, there's going to be some software that is not going to work. And she was like, okay.
Right.
And I'm like, you may have to buy new software. And there were one or two pieces of software that she had to, and actually she had to, I suggested buying a new AirPort because the other AirPort was so ancient. And right. This kind of resonates with this situation where there was the, you know, there was the realization, and I brought it up beforehand saying not everything is going to work as it did in the past. I just want to make you aware of that. And now I don't know if, if this was explicitly stated, and even if you explicitly state it, someone may feel cheated if something doesn't work. Now the only thing I can say here is that, I mean, dude, how old is the speaker system? I mean, 2002. I mean, I am amazed that it's worked this long.
Yep.
I mean, we're talking 8 years, which for any piece of hardware, computer hardware, especially these kind of wacky Apple Pro speakers. But just to lay it down here, I agree with you, is that it should be time and not necessarily results.
That's right. Well, yeah.
Because then you get in a whole world of pain, because I don't think you can ever, with all the variations and all the things Apple does and things they may inadvertently or intentionally break, you can never guarantee that there will be no repercussions. Now, maybe that should be something you indicate off the bat. Say, here's a contract, or here's just a, you know, here's a little, you know, here's what I'm going to tell you. If something breaks, I'm going to do the very best I can, as you said, Dave, to help. You and I will do our best to remedy the situation.
That's right.
But I'm with you, is that it's you and I versus the computer and Apple, and not, you know, right. Don't make it, it sounds like they've made it his problem.
Correct.
And that's unfortunate, because now he's in a position where he may lose a customer. And I think maybe well, go on. I just want to interject in what I've run into. And mostly when I run into this and people ask me to help them, if something unexpected happens, they know I didn't mean for it to happen, and I'm going to work with them to do the best I can to solve the problem.
That's right.
You know, maybe it's involving spending a little extra time, maybe giving them a discount. I don't know how he wants to handle it.
I was always very careful about giving discounts for unexpected problems, because I never, I'm not going to say it never happened. It sometimes did. But, you know, the thing is, there's the whole purpose is to have your expertise there. If all you had to do was follow steps from A to B or A to Z or whatever they are to fix the problem, the customer could do that on their own. Now, they may choose not to, but part of what they're paying you for is your expertise to deal with the unexpected problems and to make it work. But that's what they're paying you for, right? So, but you know, and with Nerds, we did get to the point where we had a customer sign a contract before we ever touched their computer. And we had to. We had too many people out in the field every day. You know, there was too much liability. And that was fine. But it is sort of a tough sell to walk, walk into someone's home and they are, you've just met them. And you're trying to build trust, and yet the first thing you're doing is making them sign their life away, saying they've backed up and they understand how the billing's going to work and all that. It very necessary in an organization of that size. However, when I was out on my own before we did Nerds and after, I never did that. But I knew I could trust myself going in that I was going to manage the customer relationship. And if I felt like there was, you know, any miscommunication or lack of understanding on their part, I could just stop. But again, it was my risk to take. It wasn't, you know, someone else's risk on the company's back. So I always chose not to do it that way, but I didn't, you know, I did form an LLC so that in case, heaven forbid, you know, I wiped out some company's data, they couldn't come take my house. But that never happened. But it really is regardless of what that agreement says, if you get to the point where this guy is, where now it's a, you know, you're butting heads, even if he had the guy sign an agreement ahead of time saying, I swear, you know, on all that is good and pure, that I will never, ever blame Greg for any problems that happened to my computer, even if I know that he caused them himself. Right. Even if the guy signs that agreement, it doesn't matter. Right. You're at now an impasse, right, where Greg feels like he needs to, you know, charge this guy. The guy feels like he doesn't want to pay. And there's some headbutting going on. Now, sometimes you're going to get a customer that's just like that. And if they're like that and you have the option, I recommend just walking away from them and not being their consultant anymore. That's what I did. And it rarely happened, but I would happily fire my customers if they weren't the kind of customers that I wanted to have. No, seriously, there's nothing wrong with that in any business. You know, you don't need a customer that's going to drive you crazy. Now, in this case, we don't know enough about it. Maybe the guy's, you know, maybe he's not being problematic about it. And maybe he's being quite reasonable about it. It could be that Greg didn't spend the time to ensure that he'd cemented that concept of it being, you know, Greg's computer and Greg's problems. The customer's computer and the customer's problems. And Greg is there to help the customer. Right. And that it's so important. And if you don't do that up front as a consultant, you're doomed. If you solve the problem, everything's hunky dory and you'll never know that there's any underlying, you know, issue there. But if you don't solve the problem, man, that stuff comes right to the surface. And, you know, here's the thing. I would walk into somebody's home and I might spend 3 or 4 hours working on their computer and not get the solution that they wanted. Right. Simply because it wasn't possible. Right. You know, they'd say, well, here's what I want to work. And you try, you do everything you can. Look, we're not there. We're not going to get there. You know, you got to know when to kind of pull your head out of the weeds and say, all right, hey, look, you know, I've been beaten on this for a couple of hours. I would always check in with the client, if not every 15 minutes, every 30 minutes, and give them an update if it was some, you know, hairy problem. Because that forced me to reevaluate the situation every, you know, on a regular basis. So I wasn't 3 hours in and then stopping and saying, gosh, I should have stopped 2 hours ago. So you got it, but involving the client in that process is huge because that way they're right there along with you. And all the decisions that have been made have been theirs, not yours. You're just guiding them and advising them, but it's their decision in the end.
Sure. I mean, in this case, I mean, Greg probably knows this, but in this case, you know, I think I tried to communicate just saying, you know, I mean, this is an unsupported, right. And they may not understand what that means. They may expect that a company will, you know, as you know, with me, Dave, I expect things last forever. They may expect that their Apple Pro speakers from 2002 will last forever with every iteration of, likewise with the iFire adapter from Griffin. They're going to expect that, well, I bought it and it should work forever and ever and ever. And maybe he could put it in the context of saying, well, you know, I mean, that this happens as you know, get newer operating systems, that things stop working. So, but it could get to an unpleasant thing. Either, you know, I can roll you back to 10.6.3, everything's going to work great, and then maybe we part ways. So I will put your system back to where it was. And then either we agree that, I don't know, because that doesn't sound great either, because then, nope. I mean, you know, there's a benefit certainly to upgrading 10.6.4, security and more features and stuff like that. So it's hard to explicitly plant the seed saying that, you know, if I do something, things may break and there's nothing I can do about it.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yep, for sure. Now,
so to wrap up, what do you think? I don't know. We've been rambling a bit here. Yeah. I think with some theoretical stuff here. I mean, if I'd ask you, Dave, what do you think he should? I think I've given my recommendation. He could either say, you know, I'll back you back to 10.6.3. Yeah, but his speakers work.
But you haven't finished your recommendation. Is he charging for the time to roll him back to 10.6.3 or no?
I would charge yes.
Yeah.
To me, the time is included.
Yeah.
If he'd like to, just as a good gesture, to maybe not charge for the full time involved.
Yeah, if it's a client,
you may want to consider that.
Yeah, if it's a client worth keeping, and many clients are, of course, because that's how we build our businesses. Then, yeah, what I might say to the guy is, hey, look, I took the time to do some research on my own for this. I'm not going to charge you for it, no matter what, for that research. But here's what I've found, and I think we got to boot from this other drive and do this. Now, you know, here's the thing: I got to come out there. I got to do this. How about we agree that we're going to split the travel time? This process should take on site. This process should take less than 15 minutes. So I'm going to charge you for the trip out, but not the trip back. And no time. And the first 15 minutes on site is on me. In theory, this problem, you know, if all my research proves correct, this problem is solved after that. If it's not, then we can decide if you want me to continue working from there. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, define before you walk in the door, define exactly what this proposal, you know, propose and define exactly what this arrangement's going to be. And then that way, you know, it helps get you back, like I said, back to the other side of the desk. It's me and you versus your computer. I think I've got an answer. What do you think about my answer? You know, that sort of thing. Try and rope them back in because that can work. And, you know, you're giving away a half hour of your time. It's not going to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So there you go.
All right, but that's the wild and wacky world of
it's customer
independent
service.
Consulting.
Yeah, every business is the customer service business. So you know you got to remember that, and you got to do that when you walk in the door. It starts, and in especially this business, not only are you there solving their problem, you're selling yourself to them. Right, the moment you walk in the door, the sales process continues. It's already happened because you've already got there, but that process continues, and you got to keep that in mind too. So it's not just. You're not selling solutions, not even close. You know, that's the furthest thing from what you're selling.
I'm with you. I think I'm with you. Is that you want to put it in the frame that this is for our time and expertise and...
Bingo.
And you can't possibly guarantee 100% results.
No way.
All the time. It's even though it's a Mac.
Right.
It's a computer.
That's right.
And you got hardware that, you know, is 10 years old. I mean, come on.
Yeah, exactly. All right, cool. Let's go on to, so hopefully that helps, Greg, and hopefully in a general sense that it's a good conversation to have. So let's move on to Kirk. And Kirk writes, when on battery power, it helps to disable the dashboard. I usually do this by issuing a terminal command to kill the dock. I was wondering if there is an Apple script or something that could issue this command automatically whenever the MacBook switched to battery power. So the command would be, I presume it's what I would do, kill all space dock with a capital D. So you could write an Apple script or I think even an automator action to issue a terminal command that would do that. And that should work. But John, you've got an even better idea.
Or, and this is something we brought up at our last show, I believe. But let me get Kirk's question up here. I'm somewhat organized here. Not as organized as you, Dave, which is why. You do what you do. he was saying when a battery. So he would like to make a distinction between running this when he's on battery power when plugged in.
Right.
Well, you know what can do this, Dave? Marco Polo.
Polo.
Yep, exactly. Marco Polo is a shut up. is a utility that I have actually used extensively, but for one I can read from looking at the documentation, one thing that it can do is detect when you're switching between AC power being plugged into the wall and battery power. So I would suggest this is like a little hybrid solution, is that get Marco Polo and then Polo. When it detects that there's been a switch to battery power, have it run an Apple script that will kill the dock. And actually, I guess there would be a complement to that, is that it could detect when you switch the other way and start it up again.
Right. Yeah, yeah, of course. That's right. Yeah, although, well, no, because it will. So when you kill the dock, you don't need to start it up again. Chances are it. And I think the reason he kills the dock is because once you start the dock the first time, all those little dock widgets are constantly running their whatever it is in the background. And some of them do more than others, of course. So but that doesn't happen until you launch the dock the first time. And it usually happens very quickly when you do. It's just that ongoing CPU usage of all those widgets can, you know, potentially cause an impact to battery life. So, yeah, you could start it back up again, but there's no I'm not sure that that's going to help, because even on this machine, I think it automatically starts itself, but it just doesn't start the widgets. I'm looking to see. Yeah, the dock's running on this machine, and I can guarantee you I haven't launched it. So it's always there. But the, you know, the widgets aren't active until after it's clicked on the first time. So, yeah, so that would do it. That would do it.
All right.
Time to go on to where, how are we doing on time here? Speaking of
an hour
time.
Let's keep going, man.
Well, let's do one more. Pick one.
I'm going to do Brian.
Okay.
Probably the most lengthy, but I think it has some good stuff.
Yeah, it is a little lengthy. You know what? We've got another premium show to do next week. I think it would be good to save Brian's for next week. I think that's a good one.
Well, why did you ask me if you did that?
I don't know, because I'm thinking about this on the fly. That's how I roll. Yeah. All right, fine. We'll do
Brian. All right. What? Now what? Or we could do Greg. We could do Brian or Greg.
All right, let's do Greg.
Okay.
Not the same Greg, though. Or not the same Greg question.
I don't think so.
No. What are we looking for here? We're going to burn all our available time left this way. Greg writes, I'm sure John was kidding about throwing his crazer in a landfill, but I wanted to tell you about earth911.com. I actually found a place to recycle everything anywhere close to you. Hazardous sprays, VHS tapes, electronics, etc. Anywhere close to whatever zip code you put in, and you can search from there. There's an app, too, as you can see from the screen cap. And he did. He sent a screen cap of an iPod Touch or iPhone app. I couldn't believe I found a Verizon Wireless 4G store that took my old VHS tapes. Also, to restart my Mac, sleep and shut down my keyboard shortcuts and system prefs is... Oh, he's the one that wrote in about the system prefs at the beginning of the show. So that's a double deal from Greg. So thank you. Earth911.com, for sure. That's great. And I know this show is a free show. Of course, it's not sponsored, but it would be remiss if we didn't mention Gazelle, right, as a place to not just recycle your stuff, but if it's worth anything, they'll actually pay you for it. So that's, that's another option. And they're not the only ones. There's other companies out there like Gazelle that do that. So it's worth mentioning.
And some other things to mention.
Yeah.
One thing I've noticed, Dave, and I believe Apple will still do this, is that if you buy a major piece of hardware from Apple, they will offer... So if you're upgrading a desktop or an iMac or whatever, I'm not sure how far it extends. We'll have to look on the site and, of course, put it in the meticulously crafted show notes that I generate a day or two after the show.
Yeah.
But Apple, I believe, will still accept hardware if you buy new hardware. They will recycle, or I don't know what the heck they do with the old hardware. But then another thing, Dave, is, for example, the town that I live in is that the dump, we'll call it the dump, though it's not just the dump, you know, they right. do a lot of things there, but they actually have an area and they actually have a little sign, and that they will kind of bend the rules here, but they contract with someone. And I actually have a picture of it. I'm actually looking at it here, and they break down electronics into three classes. So they have group one and two, small electronic devices, cell phones, pagers, blah, blah, blah. You get the idea. No charge. They have a special area when I go to the dump where if I have any small electronics, they'll take it and they will, I'm going to assume, dispose of it properly. Then they have another class, monitors up to 20 inch, PCs, TVs up to 20 inch, blah, 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 $6. And then really big TVs and stuff, $12 each. So check with your municipality and see if they, and I think a lot of them offer some sort. They may not do it directly. Like I think ours actually brings it to a place that's a couple towns away. who will then strip it down and take out all those metals and or whatever the heck they do with it. But check with your municipality first, or yeah, as an option. They may charge you, they may not. A lot of companies I know will also have programs that will let you do this. They will accept things and then they'll ship them off, or Apple themselves or whatever company you buy something from. Typically, I know the U.S. is not as strict as I know in Europe. I think they actually have laws saying that basically a company is, for the most part, and you know, this is certainly not business friendly, I guess, or
yeah,
profit friendly, but I do believe they have laws in a lot of European countries that basically say, you know, if you make a device, then it's your responsibility to help your customer figure out how to get it back, you know, without harming the environment and tossing it in landfill.
Yeah, right. Right. Oh, that's good. Yeah, my town will, at the dump, they'll take small electronics. They'll just take larger electronics and pretty much any TVs or microwaves or, you know, that sort of thing. It's, I think, $10. You got to buy a sticker to put on it, and then they'll take it from there. And then we've got somewhere else, and I forget, maybe it's got to be the same department, but it's a different location I go to if I want to drop off batteries, and they'll just take them, you know, and deal with them, which is great, you know.
Yeah, you know, that disturbs me, because I think the latest guidance I got from my town is that they say just throw them in the trash.
Well, for certain batteries that's fine, but not the big ones.
But they, but actually, yeah, because the thing is, I think at least where I am, they will actually take our trash and they bring them to a city nearby, and they actually pretty much burn it all and they generate electricity from it.
Mm. Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Huh. No, it's called like the, you know, I forget the name of the operation, but no, I've read about this, and they actually, I'm going to assume that they filter it so that, you know, it's not blowing all that stuff in the air, but we also have a yearly hazardous waste collection day where you pull up in your car. They don't allow walk-ins for whatever reason, but you pull up in your car, they make sure you're a Fairfield resident, and whatever, you know, mystery liquids or stuff. Like, I still have something when I bought the house I'll have to bring by, where it was just a jug of some liquid. I mean, it doesn't, I don't know what it is. And they'll take it, you know, so they take paints and all this stuff here. So it's a yearly thing where you basically give them all your stuff, including batteries. And like you did, I have a container full of old, you know, shot batteries that I think I'll bring by next time.
Right.
So,
right.
But I like, is that, you know, hey, you know, if you can get a few bucks for, if it's still operating, then I think that may be your best bet.
I think, yeah, for sure. All right. So, contact information. I know that if you're here and you're part of the premium show, thank you again, you know how to get in touch with us. But just in case, a couple of email addresses. So, let's start with customer support at MacGeekGab.com. If you're ever having problems with your subscription, that is the email address to email it. It's not necessarily one that we will answer questions from on the show, but it goes to Stephen Swift and whoever's helping us with that stuff, too. So, customer support at MacGeekGab.com. If you're having any trouble with your subscription at all,
okay.
You have procedural questions about it, that's the address to use.
I didn't know about that. Why didn't you tell me? Well, you just did.
There you go. Hey. You know.
Okay. Otherwise, Dave, if you have a question and you're listening to this, then I would say that you probably want to send an email to premium.
That's right. Special address just for premium subscribers. premium@macgeekgab.com is what I believe you said, Mr. Braun.
No, I said premium@macgeekgab.com.
That's right. You can, of course, call us. The same call-in number works. 206-666-GEEK. Although that all does goes to the same place, and sometimes stuff gets mixed in, but we do listen to everything eventually. We've been under a little bit of a backlog lately, but we're slowly starting to dig out. In fact, I think as of a couple of days ago, we were dug out. So that's
and for the alphabetically challenged, that's 4-3-3-5.
That's right. The alphanumerically challenged, right?
Ah,
is that what that would be?
I don't know.
Whatever.
Skype,
Mac Geek Gab on Skype, and I think that's it. We'd like to thank Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast for converting this to AAC. And, of course, CashFly provides all the bandwidth to get it from us to you.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's it. We got to roll now. I think we're back with another premium show next week.
We are.
Look at the calendar. I think that's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As always, thank you so much.
Yeah.
We love doing this. We hope you enjoyed listening to it. Have the only fun. Thing I'll say, Dave, yeah? is you can't listen to us if you get caught.
Made up.